Greetings. Welcome to As You Wish Talk Radio and the PBS Network. I'm your host, James Dillon, and we've got another great show tonight. I want to do a few announcements before the show. We are right in the middle of one of our workshops, and it's just amazing. We've got Nate Walton and Neil Kramer and Spencer Barkley and talking about the freedom technologies and pretty amazing information coming out. We're right in the middle of that workshop. And we've got a few other things going on. We've got Jay Setti here as well, and I'm sure they're listening to the show. But they've come over from Japan. It's like an offshoot of eSETI in Japan, and they've had some amazing sightings here already. And I'm sure we'll get some more things happening. They saw some ships like right on the ground and things close to the ground and moving through the trees and all kinds of things. But I was hoping we could get them on the show, but it looks like. We don't know where they are, but we'll see what happens. But anyway, a lot going on here. The guest tonight is Winston Strout. And if anybody doesn't know who Winston is, you haven't been paying attention because he's been around for a long time. He's kind of one of the pioneers of the sovereignty movement or the commerce movement and getting our rights back and learning how to get our own divine rights back and standing tall in our own divinity and staying in freedom, and he's got so many things, irons in the fire. I just want to bring him on. I don't want to wait too long and just bring him on the air because there's a lot we want to get to. We only got an hour show, and there's a lot we want to get to. So, Winston, are you with us?
Yes, I am. How's the sound?
Oh, you sound great.
Wow. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. We're doing this show from cell to cell, folks, because it seems to be the powers that were like to take down our equipment, so the Skype is enough, and our phone lines are down, so we're doing cell to cell, and it's kind of an ongoing thing here. I wish they'd finally just figure it out and say, hey, we're working for their next generations as well, you know, to get this planet turned around, but eventually they'll figure it out. But anyway, welcome to the show.
Well, glad to be here.
Yeah, there's so many different arenas I would love to get into. First, let's talk about maybe how you got into this movement, and we can start there, and then we'll see where that leads.
Oh, sure. Like so many others, you know, over the years, you know, I came in contact with the legal community and some of the difficulties and so forth that came up. I was exposed, perhaps in the 80s, to what's known as the law merchant law. I was learned a little bit about that. And then, you know, you get into the typical legal problems from time to time, maybe a court case here or there and so forth. And I was basically unsatisfied with my performance in those arenas. And then, as luck would have it, I was able to retire early. And so that gave me a lot more free time. And so there was in the community where I was living at, there was a study group. And they were studying law, and a couple of the fellows that were there were very successful in the law firm that they were operating in, basically what people refer to as common law, although it's really not common law. But in any event, they were doing pretty well in some of those arenas, and so some of the rest of us were trying to learn from their experiences so we could up our performance and so forth. And then by chance, one of the participants in that study group, he brought some cassette tapes of a seminar that had been done, and the topic of that was commercial redemption. And so we said, well, let's listen to a little bit of it and see what it has. And so we started to listen to it a little bit, and there were a bunch of new things that came up that we had never considered. And one of the things, one of the first words that we came upon that we really had to dig into was the word claim. And that kind of opened up a new avenue for us. We started to look closely at that, started to investigate some of these concepts of commercial redemption, which led us to various different ones. In the early days, there were very few individuals who had a grasp of those concepts, and so we had to travel a long way. I mean, we travel to Idaho, travel down into Southern California, just wherever we could go to find a workshop or a seminar or something like that. And it's only a consequence of that we started to shift the direction of our studies, and we started to take a real close look at commerce and at admiralty law. And so those things started to develop, and as we became perhaps more proficient, more learned, and so forth, it opened up a whole new vista for us. And then one of the first things that I realized was that there was a close correlation between commercial law, commercial principles, and so forth. There was a very close correlation to the King James Version of the Holy Bible. So I started to look closely at that, having been a Sunday school attender from my youth. I mean, I paid attention in Sunday school. And so the subject of the scriptures, the principles, and so forth, I had always been a student of. And the more I looked into commercial redemption and the concepts and so forth, the more I saw that it was a close parallel, not exactly, but a close parallel to many of the things that I had learned through study of the King James Version. Now, I'm emphasizing King James Version on purpose. King James Version is just one version of the Holy Scriptures. But the King James Version had a particular intent, and that was the chief translator. The one who oversaw the translation of King James was a man named Robert Flood. Robert Flood was a member of a secret society, which is known historically as the Priory of Zion. And he had a close connection to John Dee, Sir Francis Bacon, and some of those characters. And so in any event, the King James was translated with a particular tendency or a particular leaning toward commerce. Now, most people do not realize, but our financial system, the capitalism, free enterprise system, those are all inventions of Christianity. Now, not to be plugging Christianity here, but that is the system that has become acceptable across the planet as far as international commerce and so forth. And so if you're a Buddhist, if you're a Hindu, if you're an atheist or whatever, for the purpose of commerce, then we participate with that system. Now, that does not, say that you can't, do things other ways, but when we get involved in most of the commercial things that go on the planet today, that's what we're involved in. So my study of the scriptures, the King James Version and so forth, played very well into my understanding of commerce, commercial redemption, and some of those things. Does that kind of make sense?
Yep, it does.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, it seems like, if you stick to the basics, I'd love to get your take on that, but, the basics of, being, to your neighbors yourself, all the other basics should be in the law, but it seems that we've shied far away from that, from the basics, but it seems like there are ways to bring things back to the basics.
Sure. So our commercial systems, the finances, and so forth are based upon those basic principles, and so we have modeled our system surrounding events that were perhaps 2,000 years ago, and they're very useful. I mean, they work. And so the only problem I ever have in the world of commerce is when people misuse the principles and cause the problems. But as far as the system itself, it was set up. It ran very well. It should run very well if we will simply observe the system as it has been outlined. So,
The system, though, it seems like there has been an extreme abuse of the system, because I'd like to get your take on how we fell so far away from basic human rights, and we became so corrupt. You know, the system seems to be so corrupted that even what I've noticed is, even when you have a very strong case sometimes, or you have, you know, the law on your side, or even right on your side, it just doesn't matter when you've got, you know, these people up there in robes that have no integrity whatsoever.
Yeah, we have a few bad apples, you know, that have corrupted things, and, you know, that's what we're involved in correcting at this point. I'll say, you know, from my observation, from my position, that the system, you know, that we're operating with, you know, based upon the principles in the Bible and so forth, is not the final formula, but it is a good, very good formula. It is a very good practice to bring us to another stage, another dimension, if we want to use that kind of thought process. So a successful application of the techniques, the principles, and so forth that we have would lead one into a higher realm, into a higher dimension. So we're working on these things. What's being done on the planet right now is to correct the misuse of the financial matrix so that we can go on to something a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of shifts going on. They've got a lot of common law courts and other things coming forward right now, and a lot of even like Hawaii is going for, you know, to reestablish the you know, their own sovereignty in the Hawaiian nation. There's other states, I guess, that are looking at secession, and there's so many things going on where people are just saying, hey, we're done with external authority, and we want our power back, and we want to start governing ourselves. And, have you noticed that on a grand scale lately?
Yeah, there seems to be a general move that way. I would like to make a comment, however, on what's called common law. I think maybe that we're using the wrong word when we use the word common. On this basis, the common law historically was developed, you know, based upon history, usage, and the customs and tradition of a particular country or nation. And so the common law from one country to the next would differ according to the desires of the people. Now, for instance, in the United States of America, when it was formulated, the question was raised, which form of common law shall we use? And so they decided that they would use English common law because, again, most of the founders, you know, were English. I mean, you know, they could have adopted Anglo-Saxon common law because we did have a huge German population in the colonies at that time. But in any event, they decided upon English common law. And how does that play, for instance, with someone from, you know, Egypt? Or how does that play with someone from China? They mm-hmm. had a different common law. So in today's world, I would probably not use the word common law. I would probably just use the word law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be successful with any system, whatever form of law that you're using has to be in conformity with natural law and principles. You can't violate those things. Uh-huh. You see, the concept of law is just that. It's a concept. But when you start talking about, you know, water runs downhill, you know, and you talk about all the different things in the physical world, then if your system of doing business or for justice, for all those kind of things, if they conform to that natural law, then it would be highly likely that you will be successful in what you're doing. So again, I keep hearing the word common law bantered about in this day and age, but it might be better to drop off that word common and just say law.
Mm-hmm. I guess universal law wouldn't be, it might be a little grander scheme to look at, you know, universal law. And
I would think so.
Mm-hmm. Sticking to the basics. I know I always talk to people ask me what universal law is, and I always tell them, to me it's like universal peace and brother sisterly love and the divine right to freedom and prosperity for all and working together, you know, in harmony and cooperating with each other would be more like my idea of what universal law is, and we seem to have strayed pretty far from that.
Yeah, let me discuss that word law for a moment. Actually, law is pretty far down the line. But when you start to talk about interaction between individuals, between parties, men to men or God to man, then we're starting to talk about the contracts and agreements and all those kind of things. So if the parties to a contract successfully fulfill, their agreements and so forth, the law, the contract, then everything is good. I mean, there's no controversies, there's no problems, everybody's benefited, and down the road we go in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that sometimes in regards to our contracts with each other, with God, or with the universe, or whatever you want to say, men tend to have a tendency to go into breach of contract. In other words, they're not fulfilling the obligation that they had decided upon. Now, the law of the contract is the remedy to mend that breach. And so you understand that law is not the ultimate. It's the contract that's the ultimate. And the law only comes into play if there's a breach of contract. Now, if you go back to the Paul the Apostle, came up with, he said, all have sinned and come short of the glory, which indicates that mankind are in breach of the covenant, that they had made with God, either on this planet or before they came here. So when we start to talk about the law, as it's contained in the scriptures or other places and so forth, it's because of our misconduct, the breach of contract that mankind has done, which flies in the face of the original contract that was made with the Creator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so I don't worship the law. I worship the Creator.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
So, yeah, so getting back to that, it's kind of interesting because you're kind of screwed any way you look at it here, because you're in original sin just because of, some people could look at the Adam and Eve story, just because, they chose to grab the apple, off the tree of knowledge or whatever and take the bite out of it. In their version, you're born, in sin. You're because your forefathers sinned because of the apple story,
Date on that a bit. Now that you brought up Adam and Eve, there's a very interesting discussion that could be had on that. Whether or not that was a blow by blow account of what happened, whether it's a metaphor or whatever, there's no consequence. Mm-hmm. But it is at the basis of our commercial system and at the basis of our commercial redemption processes. Now this this first man and woman, as the story goes, went into breach of contract. However they did it, whether it was what people call original sin or whatever, I don't know. I'm kind of opposed to that word, original sin. But in any event, while they were in paradise or in the Garden of Eden, that they had committed themselves God's law, or universal law, as you referred to it. And then they went into breach on that law, and so they had to be put into a new law forum. And so in consequence of that, God basically put them into a bankruptcy. And that was, mm-hmm. it was a reorganization bankruptcy, in as much as they would not be liquidated until they had had a chance to redeem themselves, you know, through their actions. And so mm-hmm. the law forum that they went into was admiralty law, because bankruptcy is an element of admiralty, not of common law or of universal law, as you spoke there. So, mm-hmm. so they went into a reorganizational bankruptcy so that they would have a chance to repent before they died. And so that's kind mm-hmm. of the same system we have today. A lot of people don't realize it, but every country on the planet is in bankruptcy. They operate within the bankruptcy in various forms of reorganization, and that bankruptcy is administered under the admiralty jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, aren't we also considered to be dead, basically, or you know, according to that law, we're not a live man. We're actually, you know, supposedly dead.
Well, you know, that's kind of an extreme way to look at it. But more than anything else, you might look at it from the point of view is that we have an opportunity. See, not everybody that comes on the planet comes onto it at the same level of evolution or spiritual evolution or enlightenment or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come into these circumstances, you know, with whatever we bring with us and so forth. So it gives an opportunity, you know, to expand, to grow, and do all these kinds of things while we're under protection of reorganizational bankruptcy. There are several different kinds mm-hmm. of bankruptcy. Chapter 7 is generally called a liquidation bankruptcy,
mm-hmm.
but a 13 or a Chapter 11 for corporations is called a reorganization, which gives the individual or the corporation an opportunity to keep doing business under protection from the creditors, until with the hope that they can make it work out, you know, and get back on their feet and become productive once more. And so that reorganization from the story of Adam and Eve was simply, in the scriptures, he calls it the word repent. In our present commercial system, we use the word reorganize.
Mm. Yeah, I see. Well, it's interesting. I know a lot of times now I'm probably coming at this different because I've had a lot of different teachers assisting me when I had my situation with the courts that seemed to be relentless. But, you know, I went in there as a live man, as the, I kind of went in there because I know they have you as the all cap name, you know, and they call you Mr. Gilliland. If you answer to that, then they've got you underneath their jurisdiction. But, I basically said I was the beneficiary, you know, of the Gilliland estate, you know, the live man, you know, and here to settle this matter. And I can't remember exact words I used, but I used, you know, similar words like that over and over again. And they kept trying to trap me into saying, are you not Mr. Gilliland, you know? And I just said, I'm, you know, basically for people to understand, basically I'm not the all caps, you know, slave that they have me written down as, you know, I'm actually the Lord Master of my estate, you know, and I'm here to settle that estate. And you know, as the trustee, it's their job to restore the state to honor and take care of any taxes and debts and ties, which, you know, I requested for them to do. I'm curious about what your take on that. They didn't like that at all. They got pretty upset about, you know, taking that stand.
Yeah, briefly for the listening audience, what happens is that in order to function in the bankrupt situation, they incorporated all of the names basically through the use of birth certificates and social insurance applications. But when you get into a court situation, the defendant is always a corporation. It's a thing. In the Admiralty, which is the jurisdiction that administers bankruptcy, you never sue a man. You always sue a thing. Everything is an in rem proceeding, which means a thing is being sued. Okay, well, that's great. And so typically they would put your name in all capital letters, which is a corporate entity. It is a thing. It is a construct. It is a fiction. Okay, so there's no problem there. The problem comes in is because that almost everyone has subrogated their position through the application for a Social Security account by their unqualified signature on the SS-5 form or whatever they call it in whatever country you're at. So when you sign for that application, then you were construed to be the trustee of that trust, the trustee and the security on that trust. Now, what was happening, you know, in your particular situation, you know, the judge knew that you were not the defendant. I mean, everybody knows that. That's not even a question.
Yeah.
Now, you did come back properly as the living man, and so that's how you were eventually able to prevail because you maintained that status, you maintained that position. Now we have several techniques and technologies, you know, that we've developed to deal with that trusteeship. But in essence, you know, when you said, you know, that you were the beneficiary, then, you know, finally they had to relent and give in to you because you were. Mm-hmm. And so there's different understandings. You know, once people can come to understand what their true status is and present themselves, not represent like an attorney would do, but when they present themselves in those situations with the proper status, then yes, you can prevail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite interesting. It went back and forth. I don't know how many cases. I know there's at least 6 or 8 cases that I had a lot of help with, and there's cases before that, which unfortunately I hired an attorney for, which was a disaster. And, you know, they just sold me down the river. And, I realized, I learned a lot through that. I realized, you know, the attorney's job is to turn you over, to just turn you over to the courts and then try to cut a deal. And their first allegiance is not to you, it's to the courts and whatever they can seem to squeeze out of you, it seems like. And I'm not saying all attorneys are that way, but that's what I experienced, you know, in my experience. It cost me a whole lot of money with zero results. And I found out I did a lot better on my own, you know, just doing my own study and having some other helpers, you know, had some wonderful people helping me as well.
Great, great. Yeah, you can change. You have to understand that under the Admiralty system, and certainly since, well, let me go back to 1947 with the Administrative Procedures Act. You have to understand that all of these courts are not courts in the true sense of the word. They are administrative proceedings. And the party sitting up front, you know, with the black robe on, is an administrator. They are not a judge. Now, you can change the court into a court in law by making recognition of the judge's open bond. And so you can change the administrator into a judge, you know, by doing certain things and so forth, and then you can have an in-law proceeding, you know, from that point. And so, you know, the little tricks of the trade and whatnot, you know, that you have to look for. And so we've kind of figured those things out.
Yeah. Now, you do a lot of courses. You teach people how to kind of hold their own and learn you know, how to exist within this present system and how to maintain, you know, your basic freedoms as well.
Yeah, and a lot of it, believe it or not, a lot of the understanding that would help people to understand what's really going on with some of those situations is to understand the nature of money. Mm-hmm. See, what happened was, you know, my grandparents, my parents lived prior to 1933 when we had that huge changeover in the money system. And so they were raised, they lived with the hard money concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which changed in 1933, which we might have a little chance here to discuss. But in any event, you know, when I was born, I was raised, you know, by my grandparents, my parents, on that mentality. And so I did not understand the different kinds of money that had come into play. And so, I was 50 years old before I finally woke up and said, hey, there's something wrong with this money thing here. I need to investigate this.
Mm-hmm.
So when we start to talk about the courts who are administering, you know, the bankruptcy, then you have to start looking at, well, when we start talking about bankruptcy and all these kind of things, what kind of money is it that we're dealing with in these courts? And so there's a world of difference between my grandparents, my parents, who lived and operated prior to 1933, and then what happened after.
Yeah. So, well, can you discuss that? Like, what is the difference that happened? You know, what did transpire concerning money?
Yeah. First off, let's discuss it in the form of accounting. Now, you're using hard currency, such as gold or silver or whatever, you know, well, gold and silver. Let's just say gold and silver. But when you're using substance for money, then the accounting is more along the lines of warehousing. In other words, you know, where is, you know, that ton of gold today? Where is that ton of silver at today? Where is it at? And that's the kind of accounting done when you have substance. But when we went into, after 1933, we went into a different system of accounting to accommodate the nature and type of money that we were dealing with. And so we had entered into something which is known as double-entry bookkeeping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, double-entry bookkeeping was developed. There is a set of rules for it. It's called the GAAP rules, Generally Accepted Accounting Procedures. And that whole procedure is based around the concept of double-entry bookkeeping. And so we changed the nature of our accounting so that we could arrive at some measure of fairness and equity for everybody. And so we have to take that into consideration. Now, in double-entry bookkeeping, the goal of that bookkeeping is to arrive at zero balance. Now this is an interesting concept, and for all you physics majors out there who understand zero energy field, this should be obvious to you. I mean, you know, water flows downhill, you know, the mountains erode, and all that. So we're looking for that homeostasis, we're looking for that balance in nature, and we're looking for that same thing with our accounting. And that is to demonstrate, you know, asset versus debit to equal zero demonstrates fairness and equity to the parties that are involved. Now, that brings in a new concept, which is called money of account. Now, money of account is simply bookkeeping, a ledger entry. It's simply numbers that are put on a piece of paper, or it's numbers that are kept on a computer electronically and so forth. And so that is not substance related. The only thing that double entry bookkeeping addresses and money of account addresses is the transactions that occur. And so we've kind of moved, you know, I mean, it would take me maybe 2 or 3 hours to adequately build a foundation to make the statement that I'm making. However, at some point, you know, people need to study the difference between money of account and money of exchange, which has energy attached to it. Now, I did produce a few years ago a single topic DVD to describe the difference between money of exchange and money of account. And that would be a real good study, you know, for people to understand that difference. Because when we start talking about, you know, what is it that we're moving towards? And James, you and I have had this discussion about what do things look like in the future if we ever get a chance to do, you know, some kind of interrelations with ETs or people from other places who do not use money. They do not use cash. They do not have banks. They don't do any of these things. And so are we prepared? Do we have the concepts in place so that we could have that interchange with some who would come here? And the answer is, yes, we do, upon proper study and so forth. And so the students and those who are listening, you know, to this broadcast and whatnot, would do well to understand the difference between money of exchange, money of account, or what we call cash transactions versus non-cash transactions. And they'll find that the transactions in the public involve themselves with non-cash. And then when we get involved in private affairs and so forth, then we're talking about cash or money of exchange. And the problem that has occurred is that the courts, even though they are dealing with non-cash item negotiable instruments, will try to give a judgment in specie or in money of exchange, which is called conversion. Now, the courts are not legally licensed to do conversion as the banks are. And so what the courts are doing is actually illegal when they demand specie for a non-cash judgment. Does that make any sense?
Kind of in a way. I think to clear it up, we might need to go a little deeper in that. If you could clarify, let's say they charge you with a $1,000 fine and whatever else, and pay at the window. You know, pay on the way out.
Yeah. Well, let's go into that. Let's start from the start to get to the final answer to your question there, and that is. For the list, one of the first things that I studied when I started to contemplate going into these arenas was I studied negotiable instrument law. Mm-hmm. And that's a key study because it is obvious to me that any complaint or any indictment that comes into any court is, in fact, a negotiable instrument. Mm-hmm. Now, as a negotiable instrument, we're talking about money of account, you see. And so the negotiable instrument, when it comes in, it's generally put in by an attorney. Sometimes we do our own. But in any event, that negotiable instrument is taken to the clerk. The clerk will look it over to make sure it's a proper instrument, at which point they take it in to the court, which is, in fact, just a bank by that definition. But they take it into the court, and at that point, the court becomes a third-party debt collector.
Yeah.
So the question is, on the negotiable instrument, It's pretty obvious the various parties and so forth, and they're looking to see who is the payor and who is the payee. So that's what they're really looking for. Now, because the instrument is written against a corporate entity, which is basically an estate, you know, it's your estate on the trust side and so forth. And so they're really looking to see who's going to pay this negotiable instrument, who's going to make it good. Now, if you go to the history of admiralty law, you find, you know, there's a certain practice, you know, that they went through. Now, for instance, when a ship came into port and there was a controversy, such as maybe there had been some kind of, you know, one of the sailors had a complaint about the pay, that perhaps there had been some kind of problem with bills of lading, and, you know, just different things.
Mm-hmm.
When it came into port, the complaint was taken to the Admiralty Court, and then the court would tell the bailiff to go out and chain or tie the ship to the dock so it couldn't leave until the controversy was settled. So then what the clerk of the court would do, they would notify the owner of the vessel that there was a complaint and they needed to come to court to settle the thing so that the ship could be released back, you know, to keep doing commerce. And so the owner would have to show up with fiduciaries and surety in order to secure their seat. So that's how it works in the Admiralty. Now, so when a complaint or an indictment or whatever comes in, the defendant is written in all capital letters. And when you go to the United States government style manual, it will show you that anything written in all capital letters is either a U.S. vessel, a corporation, or a dead person, or all three. That's what they're dealing with. So what do they do then? They notify the last known owner of that vessel, and the owner has to bring in fiduciary and surety in order to secure the release of that vessel back into commerce. Now, because of your signature on the SS5 form, you have been construed to be the trustee surety for that all capital letter vessel, corporation, dead person. See? So you have to show up. You have to show up. So they're relying upon you to settle and pay that negotiable instrument. Now, but, you know, the thing that people get tricked with is that because the complaint of basically being a chosen action, which is a new word for a lot of people, but anyway, because it's a fiction, then the remedy has to also be in the fiction. And so people are generally fooled into thinking that a judgment has to be paid in money of exchange when only money of account is required. Mm-hmm. So we've developed the various techniques and so forth to make those settlements and so forth using money of account. And that really sets them all down at the courthouse because they're really expecting to get cash out of that. I'm not entitled to it.
Yeah, so basically you just send them a bond, I guess, a bond connected to your fiction or whatever, and say, well, here, have the fiction pay for it.
Bonds are not actually negotiable instruments. The remedy would be a promissory note or a bill of exchange.
And would that be tied to your fiction, right? To say, okay, settle this with the fiction.
Yeah, again, it's all in the fiction.
Yeah.
And so the courts tried to coerce or threaten and so forth to get people to bring in money of exchange or what we call specie or equity money, you know, something that you have tied to. But it's not required because of House Joint Resolution 192 of June the 5th, 1933, when we had the big changeover.
See? Oh, okay. Yeah. So the I don't know. I'm trying to remember. There are ways of. I know Spencer works a lot with that, with the setting off the debt. You know, by just charging it back to the fiction. You know, okay, here's my Social Security number. You know, to charge it back to that trust, and you know, and it's had pretty good luck with that.
Yeah, there's different techniques and technologies we've developed over the years to accommodate this. The system, the judges, the courts, and so forth, because 99% of the people that come in there don't know the difference between money of exchange and money of account. They're generally able to coerce or to trick people into bringing in money of exchange on a non-cash item, you see. And so they're used to it. And so then when somebody like, you know, me or you or Spencer or whoever pops up and says, oh, okay, here you go. There's a promissory note. They go ballistic over it. But if you understand
they did.
Hold them to
it. We did that. We did that with our permits. You know, they fined us for all these permits and said, okay, here, charge it to the estate. So it was kind of funny, you know. They didn't know what to do with it. They got really upset about that. It went round and round and round, but, you know, finally they just dropped it. But, you know, I wanted to go further into this as far as I know that there's some amazing events that I don't know how much you can talk about, but as far as the new money system and changes in the new money system and, you know, kind of an end to the tyranny that we've been experiencing for so long and the enslaved through debt, I'd love to hear your take on that and some of the things that you're seeing unfolding to give people a little bit of hope for the future.
Okay. One of the things that has been key is what's called the Basel Agreement. Now, the Swiss have always, you know, the Queen's Council have always been considered, you know, the kind of the policemen of the banking and finances and so forth. And so over a period of a number of years now, there has evolved what's called the Basel Agreement. Basel 1, 2, and 3, we're into Basel 3 right now. And one of the key elements of Basel 3 is transparency. In other words, when they walk into a bank, you know, they examine the books and they say, where did this money come from?
Yeah.
So banks have to do a prove up on how they obtain that particular money. If it's found that it was gotten illegally, if they did some kind of illegal trading, you know, against the collateral accounts and so forth and so on, they'll simply remove those numbers, you know, from the bank's ledger. So the only thing that the banks will be able to claim as an asset is money that they have legally gotten and not money, you know, that they have gotten by illegal trading and some of these other things. So all these what's called toxic derivatives and all these kind of things will simply be done away with. So that's one of the key things that has happened and is being enforced at the present time. Now, some of the other things that are going on, it gets pretty deep, and I kind of hesitate sometimes to discuss, you know, the depths to which it goes, but right now there's a retraction going on from the high sources, but it comes down to this, and that is there has been a movement that was principally sponsored by the White Dragon Society in regards to a revaluation of the world's currency. Now, a lot of people don't realize exactly why that was done, but one of the main purposes of that revaluation was to break the hold of the petroleum industry, upon the world. And that is what we call the Federal Reserve note, or the U.S. dollar, you know, has been listed as petrodollars. And so one of the things was worked on to break the hold of the petroleum cabal in particular the Rockefellers, you know, the Bushes and all that bunch,
mm-hmm.
but was to sever the debt that was owed by the oil-producing countries, to get them independent of the petroleum industry. Now, you know, most people are old enough to remember, you know, what happened when Saddam Hussein told the United States that he would no longer accept Federal Reserve notes in payment for oil. Bush attacked him.
Oh, yeah.
It's gone on for a long time. And so, you know, slowly but surely, you know, that's getting rectified. And now we have, for instance, Russia is saying to Europe, hey, if you want our gas, here's how you'll have to pay for it. And then we
uh-huh.
have, the BRICS nations are rising, putting a lot of pressure on. The IMF really having problems now. The Bank of International Settlements and all those kind of things are having to square up face reality that they simply cannot terrorize the financial community of the planet with their techniques and technology, which has put us into the financial mess we're in now. So mm-hmm. we have these uprisings, if I can use that word, where the various countries and so forth are simply resisting the tyranny of the petroleum cabals. Now, hopefully, mm-hmm. you and I both know that we can get away from this petroleum altogether, but certainly this is a good first step.
Yeah, and actually, it's probably going to open up the doorway to all the fuelless energy technologies and water technologies and even healing technologies. It seems that are going to start coming out of the woodwork, because I know they're everywhere right now. They're in people's garages, basements, and labs all over the place, and they're getting ready to come out. And I think it's a very short time before when this cabal is removed that all those new technologies will have a quantum leap in technology and evolution as well.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, here within the last week or so, the Rockefeller cabal has announced they're going to move away from petroleum and move into alternative energy. Now, what caused that to happen?
Yeah. Do you think it's the BRICS? The BRICS alliance that created that?
I think it's a combination of all the pressure that's been put on, certainly the RV effort. It had a lot to do with it, certainly the BRICS alliance and so forth and so on. And, I guess the Rockefeller folks, saw the handwriting on the wall and said, hey, we don't get away from this now, we're going to lose everything we have.
Uh-huh.
And they would have. And I don't know to what extent they're going to move away. But certainly, knowing that much, they'll probably try to move in and try to take a monopoly on the alternative energy, but I don't think they'll be able to.
Yeah, I don't either. I think there's shifts and changes and energetic changes that have not been taken into account, that if they're not frequency specific to the evolution of the Earth, they're not going to be around. I don't care how big their kingdoms are, how much money they have, or how much protection. It's all about evolving and going with the flow of creation, or whatever you want to call it, or the will of creator. Everybody has a different name for it. But, any way you look at it, we're taking a quantum leap right now in consciousness and in evolution, and they have to get with the program, or they're not going to be able to sustain themselves or their kingdom.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, they're it's kind of a last-ditch effort, I think, on their part to maintain, something. As they lose control of the petroleum industry, they're the ones who have actually suppressed the development of other energy sources rather than petroleum and gas and so forth. And so it's, on their part, it's a smart move. I mean, it's all the handwriting on the wall. Their effort will be to try to control that market like they have the petroleum market, but I don't think they'll be successful.
No, I don't either. There's too many of, these other alliances, these other countries are going to come out with it. The only thing they could do, which I've seen they have been semi-successful in that. I know China came out with some solar panels that are super efficient. They're just amazing, and they make kind of solar energy. It makes sense out of solar energy now because of the efficiency of these panels, but we can't get them. We can't even get these panels into our country right now. You can get them into Mexico. And I can't remember how much, I forgot the numbers on how much more efficient they are, but it's like having one panel versus five, you know, with the same output. So it's, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's the low level stuff going on. There's other technologies that they're getting ready, you know, to surface.
About one minute.
Yeah, we're coming up to the end of the hour, unfortunately. So is there a way that people get in touch with you if they want more information or to attend some of your seminars?
Yeah, if they want to go on the Internet, we have our website up. It's called WSSIC.com, which stands for Winston Shrout Solutions in Commerce. Lecturing for about the last, next month will signify 10 years. You know, that I've been lecturing and developing technology, doing seminars, producing DVDs, and all sorts of things. So if they want to go to that website, WSSIC, Winston Shrout Solutions in Commerce, you can look over the various things we have. We have posted a great number of YouTube presentations on that website where you can learn about, you know, various subjects that people have requested interviews on, much like this one right here. So, yeah, there's a lot out there for folks.
Awesome. Hey, well, unfortunately, we hit the end of the hour. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and I know we just hit the tip of the iceberg on some of these things, and so I know, you know, when it's time, you'll probably be able to talk about some of these big revolutions that are happening. So when that time comes, we'll bring you on the show again. Does that sound good to you?
Well, sure. We're always happy to spread as much love and joy as we can.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's a great honor, and we'll be talking soon.
Oh, great. Thanks.
All right. Well, this is James Hill with As You Wish Talk Radio signing off. Have a great evening, and watch the skies and watch the changes. They're happening, and it's a good thing. Just flow with the changes and don't be attached to, the old programs, because they're coming to an end. Anyway, have a good evening.